British Sky Broadcasting presents Mission Impossible, starring Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt, with John Voight, Emmanuel Béart and Vanessa Redgrave. Voiced by Neville Watchhurst on behalf of MCS Agency. The Paramount logo unfurls. A title reads Kiev. A man sits studying a small monitor. Behind him stands a young woman in traditional Russian dress. On the screen, two men pace in a bedroom. On the bed lies a woman soaked in blood and seemingly dead. The men's conversation is subtitled. It was good of you to call us. I don't know what happened. We were at a bar, drinking, having fun. I don't even know how I got here. The first speaker pulls up one of the young woman's eyelids. The man observing the screen looks at his watch.
Come on, she's been at it too long.
You're the only one who can help me. The pleading man grabs at the sleeve of the man in charge, who becomes angry and slaps the distressed man around the head and then bends down close to his ear. Come on, tell me what I need to know, come on. The distressed man shakes his head. They'll kill me. The man in charge casts a look towards the dead woman. You ask for my help? Come on. The man observing the screen is becoming frustrated.
Come on. Name now, give us the name.
The contact in Minsk, says the distressed man, Dmitry Mediev. The man observing eagerly keys the name into his computer. The young woman standing behind him squeezes drops of a clear liquid into a glass on the tray she holds. The observer nods approvingly as the name registers. The young woman leaves the observation room and appears on the screen. The distressed man asks, "What now?" "Now we drink," says the other man. The observer toasts the scene with his styrofoam cup. The distressed man downs his glass of vodka, then his mouth gapes and he falls headlong to the floor. The other man jumps up and hurries across to the door, which he opens into the observation room. He raises a hand to his craggy Slavic features and then pulls off the rubber mask, revealing the clean-cut, smooth face of Ethan Hunt.
Get rid of that scum.
The young woman in Russian dress bangs on the wall, which slides away. The whole bedroom scene was a mere set. As a pair of leather-jacketed stooges cart away the inert body, Ethan sits on the bed and injects the arm of the seemingly dead woman. He gazes down solicitously and puts his right hand to her cheek. She stirs as if waking from a voluptuous sleep, brushing his hand with her full lips. She finally opens her eyes. Ethan sighs and drops his head in relief.
We got it.
The Mission Impossible fuse is lit and urgently burns as images of the action to come flash up onto the screen. A title reads, a Brian De Palma film. A sophisticated, late middle-aged man sits contemplating a framed photo of a woman as he sits on a plane.
Would you like to watch a movie, Mr. Rosen?
No, thank you.
The first-class stewardess approaches the man looking at the photo.
Would you like to watch a movie, Mr. Phelps?
I prefer the theatre.
Would you consider the cinema of the Ukraine?
Perhaps you'll choose one for me.
Phelps takes the cassette from the stewardess and slots it into the player. He slips on a pair of headphones and tilts the in-flight screen towards himself. He presses the button.
Good morning, Mr. Phelps. The man you're looking at is Alexander Golitsyn, an attaché at our embassy in Prague. He is also a traitor. He has stolen one half of a CIA knock list, a record of all our deep cover agents working in Eastern Europe. For security reasons, the knock list is divided in two. The portion that Golitsyn already has contains code names, but this half is useless without its mate, which matches the code names with their true names. It is this half which Golitsyn plans to steal from the embassy during a reception tomorrow night. Your mission, Jim, should you choose to accept it, is to obtain photographic proof of the theft, shadow Golitsyn to his buyer, and apprehend them both. I've already dispatched a team selected from your usual group. Sarah Davies is already undercover. Jack Harmon can hack into any security system. Hannah Williams will handle surveillance. Your wife, Claire, will cover transport. And Ethan Hunt will be your point man, as usual. He is now in Kiev and will rendezvous in Prague at a safe house of your choosing. As always, should you or any member of your IM force be caught or killed, the secretary will disavow all knowledge of your actions. This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Jim.
Jim Phelps lights one of his cigarettes and times his exhalation so that it blends with and covers the puff of smoke issuing from the self-destructing tape. A mid-European Gothic church perches on the bluff above a wide river. A couple walk along a narrow riverside street in the lee of a building of golden stone. Jim Phelps walks in the other direction and locates a doorway. A title reads, Prague.
Very straightforward objective. We photograph Golitsyn stealing the knock list, follow him to his buyer. Apprehend both of them. Now, here's the plot. Ethan, you're going into the embassy in character, during a party. Hide in plain sight, highest possible profile. Are you game?
Wouldn't have it any other way.
Sarah, you're at the party already. As the embassy's Washington visitor liaison, make contact with Ethan. You'll run the game together.
I haven't a thing to wear.
Well, I'm sure you'll work it out. You'll mark Golitsyn and hand him off to Hannah. Hannah, you'll have him for the duration of the interior. Find yourself a perch and stay on him.
No problem.
Jack.
Yeah?
Fingerprint security. There's access through the elevator shaft here.
So I guess I'm not wearing my tux.
Open, close, get out. Zero residual presence. Claire.
Mm-hmm?
You'll cover outside in the vehicle. Hannah will join you as Golitsyn goes exterior. You two stay on him from there.
Okay.
Anything goes wrong, I call abort. Everybody walk away immediately. Regroup here at 4 a.m. That's 0400. Any questions?
Yeah. Can we get a cappuccino machine in here? Because I don't know what you call this.
I call it cruel and unusual.
I made that coffee.
Exactly. Is it possible it's even worse than the sledge you made in that barn in Kiev?
Thank you.
Hey, take it easy on my wife's coffee, will you?
Oh, we missed you in Kiev, Jim.
Missed you too, Ethan.
Are we off on one of your cushy recruiting assignments again?
Where'd they put you up this time? The Plaza?
Drake Hotel, Chicago.
Oh, punishing. 24-hour room service.
Yeah, chauffeured cars.
Bad expense account.
Now he's getting soft in his old age.
Yeah, he is. Look at him.
Okay, listen. If that list gets out into the open, the names of our agents in every country in Eastern Europe will be up for grabs to the highest bidders. Third world terrorists, arms dealers, drug lords, any and everybody who'd love to get rid of long-term coverts like us. If they're exposed, they'll be executed. So, I'll run the whole show from the crow's nest here. Everyone knows their roles. Let's punch out the details.
There's a camera built right into the bridge. Whatever you see, it sees, and then it transmits it back here. See? Can you hear me?
Of course I can hear you.
No, in your room. Need in your piece.
Jack hands Sarah the piece and whispers into his watch.
You have lovely eyes. Can you hear me now?
Loud and clear.
If he has a car waiting and he rolls, you stay with him no matter what. You should take the afternoon drive the streets around this little quarter. They're confusing as hell.
What do you think I've been doing all morning?
We're using Walzer?
He's our guy.
Isn't he chairing the armed services hearing?
Not this week. This week he's fly fishing at the Ouderard Slough in County Kildare with one of our best Irish guides.
Yeah, and he won't be back in time soon.
Irrelevant at best or unconstitutional at worst. With all due respect, Senator, it sounds as if you want to lead the kind of charge that Senator Frank Church led in the 1970s and in the process destroy the intelligence capability of this country.
Now, I want to know who these people are. And how they're spending our taxpayers' money. We were living in a democracy the last time I checked.
Stick of gum, right?
No.
No. Red light, green light. You come up against a lock you can't pick, you mash them together. Hasta lasagna, don't get any on you. You'll have about 5 seconds.
Ethan takes the explosive from Jack.
Just don't chew it.
The elaborate staircase of the embassy teems with expensively dressed guests and waiters carrying trays. Jack pushes open a metal door into what appears to be a lift shaft. He looks upwards, clocking what looks like a junction box fixed to the wall halfway up the shaft. An image of the junction box appears in a small window marked Jack on Phelps's computer screen in the crow's nest. Each of the other agents has a similar window on the screen, relaying what they are picking up through their cunning camera spectacles.
Ethan, Jack's inside. Let's go.
A man hurries down steps to greet Ethan.
How do you do, Senator? I'm Rand Houseman, the ambassador's aide.
Oh, Mr. Howard.
How was the opera?
It was boring.
Let me see if I can steer you through this reception line.
Jack makes his way up the lift shaft by climbing up the elevator mechanism.
Windows open by 2300.
Peter Brandl, the mayor of Prague.
How do you do, sir?
And Mrs. Brandl.
I bet you don't remember me, do you?
Well, of course I do. How are you, Miss Norman?
He's in pocket on the stairway.
Sarah grins fixedly and indicates Golitsyn with her eyes.
Mr. Golitsyn, nice to see you.
Hannah.
Hannah leans on a balustrade above Golitsyn. Hannah discreetly adjusts something on her large tinted glasses. Her view of Golitsyn now turns to grainy black and white. Sarah sprays Golitsyn's hair with a small atomizer.
Sarah, mark the package. Go to the devil.
Hannah's glasses show her Golitsyn's hair glowing yellow.
Your advance team mentioned that you'd like a tour of the facility, so I've gone ahead and set one up. Excuse me.
Sir?
This way. Thank you.
Sarah spirits Ethan away from the party. In the shaft, the elevator starts to descend. Jack has to hastily tuck himself into a recess. The lift stops level with him.
Oh, great.
Which leads to the denied area, which is the only limited access area in the whole facility.
Sarah walks down the deserted corridor with Ethan, who is disguised in a rubber mask of Senator Walzer. She presses her thumb to the entry button of the denied area. The lift descends. Jack leaps onto the roof of the car. A man scrutinizes a screen which appears to be analyzing Sarah's thumbprint. Jack places an electronic device onto the roof of the lift.
Governor's in position now.
The man analyzing the thumbprint appears skeptical and exchanges a look with a colleague who gets up and walks out into the corridor where Ethan and Sarah are standing.
Excuse me, can I help?
Sorry. As you can see, there's a marine guard and video surveillance and this place is... Excuse me, I'm sorry. No, it's in here somewhere.
Now, Sergeant, why are you not in your uniform this evening?
In order to wear civilian clothes this evening,
sir. Be right back.
Tell me, Senator, do you not have someone on your staff named Jack?
Jack? Well, I believe we did have a Jack.
An unreliable fellow, as I recall, constantly late.
And behind in his work. We were forced to tie him behind one of my best stallions.
And drag him around
my barn for a few days.
Relax your crap, Foghorn. I'm working on it.
Jack works feverishly at a small computer screen in the lift shaft. At the same time, the two security men study their screen. Finally, the suspect thumbprint is matched to a photo of Sarah.
Sorry, sir. Thank you. Have a nice evening.
Thank you.
Sarah and Ethan pass through the now open door and into the lift. Jack remains on the roof as the lift descends. Ethan and Sarah look up through the grill towards Jack.
That date with Sarah is definitely off.
Ethan shoots his cuffs and stalks out of the lift with Sarah into a high-tech operations room in the basement of the embassy. She goes to sit at a workstation. Ethan tilts his head to find a good camera angle on where she sits. Golitsyn, his head glowing yellow, moves through the embassy towards the denied area. Ethan places his camera spectacles on top of a filing cabinet facing the workstation and goes over to take Sarah's place. Golitsyn casually trots down a flight of stairs.
Fire.
Sarah raises the camera specs by placing a book under them. Hannah observes Golitsyn.
He's heading to the denied area.
Get moving, Ethan.
is rolling to you.
Ethan and Sarah, leaving the specs focused on the workstation, head back towards the lift. He presses the down button, but the lift indicates up.
Jack.
Jack, we're in position here.
Jack.
I didn't touch it.
Galitzin waits for the lift to arrive at his level.
Put on my coat, I'm going to freeze.
Jack, open the doors.
Jack seems powerless to stop the lift. Sarah wraps a coat around her shoulders. Galitzin gets into the lift.
He's in the box, Ethan. He's in the box.
Okay. Taking Galitzin's exit. Open these doors.
I don't have
it. I'm opening the doors. Go under.
Go.
Ethan and Sarah leap through the open door to the lift shaft and crouch in the small space left by the descending lift car. Galitzin casually gets out of the lift and crosses to the workstation. Slipping on gloves, he opens up the computer and inserts a disk into the machine. The spectacles remain trained on him, and an image of the workstation is transmitted to a tiny screen on Ethan's wrist.
He's got it.
All right.
Saved your ass again, Jack.
Give me a break, Pops.
Such a nice house. And a lonely ass.
Transport in 5 minutes.
Yes, indeed.
Ethan rips the latex mask from his face. Galitzin retrieves his disk from the computer. Phelps observes him. Ethan and Sarah crouch as they walk out through the lift shaft service hatch and out into the open air by the riverside. Galitzin gets up to go. Ethan and Sarah walk away from the embassy. Galitzin presses the lift button. Ethan and Sarah, masquerading as smiling lovers, lean up close against the wall of a building.
Jack, we're in position. Open the doors and let the package roll.
Roger that. Opening doors now.
Stairway, you're wrapped.
Go to transport.
Hannah removes her glasses and leaves. Jack looks around as the lift ascends.
Hey.
Jack, what are you doing?
I'm not doing anything.
The lift continues upwards. Onto Phelps' screen flashes a red message reading system access error.
I don't have control, Jack.
Oh, then I got a problem.
Cut the power. Cut the power, Jack. Come on, Jack. Cut the power.
Jack.
Jack's desperate attempts to cut the power prove futile. He is driven face first into a sharp metal duct.
Jack. Jack. Jack.
Jack, do you copy? Jack?
Man down, Ethan.
Man down.
Ethan winces. The lift door slides open. Galitzin gazes into the empty shaft. Phelps, as if in panic, knocks over his chair as he grabs his coat. Galitzin leaps down into the bed of the shaft and heads for the service door.
Ethan, stay where you are. I'm coming to you.
A couple in evening dress clutching a bottle of champagne stagger past. Galitzin emerges onto the riverside.
The package is out in the open.
Jim? He's in the open.
Unroped.
Phelps runs through the streets. Sarah observes Galitzin lighting a cigarette. The drunken couple horse around perilously on the sloping cobbles of the riverbank. Jim runs across a bridge overlooking them and then turns with a look of anguish.
Jim is in the open. Jim, the package is in the open.
I've got a shadow.
Can you lose him?
No. Abort.
Ethan, he's out of pocket.
Galitzin walks away along the bank towards the bridge.
I can't do that.
We're being ambushed, Ethan. Abort, that's an order.
Negative. Galitzin is on the move.
No, damn it, no!
I said abort!
Ethan grimaces and punches the wall in exasperation.
Is there an eye in the package, Jim? I'm coming to you.
Jim gave an abort. We should walk away.
No, we are going to recover that disc. You understand me? Now go.
Ethan heads out into the misty street. He walks at speed, casting searching looks around him as he goes. Sarah emerges onto the riverbank, keeping a careful eye on the retreating figure of Golitsyn. Jim walks across the bridge.
Where are you?
About 200 yards from the bridge.
They're covering this frequency.
Cut all radio communication.
Repeat. Cut all radio communication.
Ethan continues along the street. Jim's wife, Claire, sitting at the wheel of a parked car, watches him pass, her expression troubled. He crosses the street and heads up the stone steps leading to the bridge. He stops and puts his hand to his earpiece. Onto the tiny screen on his wrist come images of a gun being fired and then of Phelps' bloody hands clutching his stomach. Ethan races up the steps. Phelps topples over the stone balustrade of the bridge and falls down into the river way below. Ethan arrives on the scene and stares down into the water and then wildly up and down the deserted bridge.
Sarah, abort. Repeat, abort. Abort! Do you read me?
Sarah stands in the mist, observing Golitsyn.
Sarah.
God.
Ethan dashes away. Sarah continues to observe Golitsyn, who now strolls further along the bank. She follows. Hannah looks around nervously and then gets into the parked car. Ethan races to the parapet in time to see the car explode dramatically.
Oh my God.
Ethan runs back down the steps from the bridge. Sarah sees Golitsyn as he is pulled violently up against a fence by an unseen hand. The couple who were feigning being drunk now observe closely. Sarah moves in on Golitsyn. As she comes close, she recoils as if in shock. Ethan races across the cobbles and round the corner onto the riverbank. He spots Sarah slumped in the gateway. He runs to her and takes her in his arms. Pulls away, holding in his hand a vicious clasp knife covered in Sarah's blood. Up the river comes a police launch. Ethan stands and pulls Golitsyn's dead body around so he can go through his pockets. The disc has gone. As the police jump onto the bank, Ethan shins up and over the gate and runs off down the cobbled alley. Ethan runs frantically through the streets until he finds a phone box. He inserts a small electronic device into the mouthpiece and impatiently screws it back together. He dials, and as he waits, wipes his bloody hands on a handkerchief.
Blackcom 7.
Central Europe unsecured.
Designator?
Bravo, Echo 1-1.
Switching. This is Kittredge.
Go secure.
Okay, go ahead.
This is Ethan Hunt. They're dead.
Wait, who's dead?
My team. My team is dead!
Jesus.
Golitsyn's gone.
They knew we were coming, man. They knew we were coming, and the disc is gone.
Are you intact?
The disc is gone. Do you read me? The list is in the open!
Listen, I read you. Let's just bring you in safely, then we'll worry about that, okay? Or you fall.
I don't think so.
Sure. Are you clean? Okay, location green, 1 hour. I'll be there myself.
You're in Prague.
1 hour.
Ethan walks shamblingly across a wide square, his face set in a desperate grimace. He heads for a restaurant above which, in large blue neon script, is written the word Akvarium. The upper floors and part of the small dining area below are indeed given over to a gigantic fish tank, which is lit in a similar ice blue to the neon sign. A man sitting alone at a table in the restaurant window casts a look across at Ethan as he draws near. Ethan walks up 3 steps and enters the restaurant. He approaches the table in the window at which sits a clean-cut, grey-haired man who drops his gaze as Ethan sits down opposite him.
I can't tell you how sorry I am. I know how much Jim in particular meant to you, Ethan, personally as well as professionally. Yeah.
The man reaches into his jacket pocket.
It's a passport visa, usual drill. We'll work the exfiltration through Canada, debrief you at Langley, throw the Prague police a bone or two, you know, toss them a few suspects. You follow me?
Yeah, I follow.
I think we've lost enough agents for one night.
You mean I've lost enough agents for one night?
You seem hell-bent on blaming yourself, Ethan.
Who else is left?
Yeah. I see your point.
Why was there another team?
What?
Of IMF agents at the embassy tonight.
I don't quite follow you.
Let's see if you can follow me around the room. The drunk Russians on the embankment at 7-8 o'clock. The couple waltzing around me at the embassy at 9 and 11. The waiter standing behind Hannah at the top of the stairs. Bow tie, 12 o'clock. The other IMF team. You're worried about me. Why?
Well, for a little over 2 years, we've been spotting serious blowback in IMF operations. We have a penetration. The other day, we decoded a message on the internet from a Czech we know as Max.
The arms dealer.
That's right. Max, it seems, has 2 unique gifts, a capacity for anonymity and for corrupting susceptible agents. This time, he'd gotten to someone on the inside. He'd gotten himself in a position to buy our knock list. Operation he referred to as Job 314, the job he thought Galitzin was doing tonight.
But the list Galitzin stole was a decoy.
That's correct. The actual list is secure at Langley. Galitzin was a lightning rod. He was one of ours.
This whole operation was a mole. She was involved.
Yeah. The mole's deep inside. And like you said, you survived. I'll show you something, Ethan. Since your father's death, your family's farm has been in receivership. Now, suddenly, they're flush with over 120 grand in the bank. Your father's illness was supposed to have wiped out that bank account. Dying slowly in America, after all, can be a very expensive proposition. So, why don't we quietly get out of here
onto a plane.
Ethan has pulled out his explosive gum.
You can understand you're very upset.
Kittredge, you've never seen me very upset.
All right, Hunt. Enough is enough. You have bribed, cajoled, and killed, and you have done it using loyalties on the inside. You want to shake hands with the devil, that's fine with me. I just want to make sure that you do it in hell.
Ethan squeezes the gum in his fist and then lobs it against the glass of the aquarium. Water from the huge aquarium deluges the restaurant, washing away people and furniture. Ethan leaps through the shattered glass frontage and sprints away across the cobbled square, just in front of the spreading wave. He cautiously climbs a flight of stone steps onto street level and goes through the doorway to the crow's nest. He climbs the elegant spiral staircase of the apartment building. At the top, he pauses and pulls off his jacket. He wraps it round the light bulb and unscrews it. He crushes the bulb in the jacket and scatters the shards onto the tiled floor of the landing. Switching off another lamp by the front door, he lets himself into the apartment. He looks wearily around at the scene, which is as Phelps had left it, the chair knocked over and the computer screen still live. Ethan grabs a gun hidden in a plant pot and locates a handful of passports. In the bathroom now, he stuffs things into a hold-all.
Money. Where's the damn money?
He vigorously soaps the blood from his hands. Back in the main room, he picks up the fallen chair. He stands looking down at the screen, which still has the live feed from the embassy denied area.
The other day we decoded a message on the internet from a Czech we know as Max. He got himself in a position to buy our Knocklist, operation he referred to as Job 314.
Ethan pulls up an internet link. There is no result for his search for Job 314. Ethan tries various other routes, drawing blanks on all of them and becoming increasingly exhausted. He scrolls through an enormous list of sites. He tries to shake away his weariness. His eyes rest on the spine of a holy Bible on the shelf.
Job 3:14.
He gets up and crosses swiftly to the shelf, returning to the desk with the Bible and urgently flicking through till he gets to the book of Job, chapter 3, verse 14. I would be at sleep and at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who built for themselves places now lying in ruins. He now keys in Bible and then narrows his search to Job 3:14. There is a Book of Job discussion group to which he now emails a message to Max. Max, goods tainted, consider extremely hazardous, do not use. Fate will be that of kings and counselors who built for themselves places now lying in ruins. Meet to discuss ASAP. Consider extremely Having sent off this email, he now proceeds to work through all the similar discussion groups he can find, sending messages in the appropriate language to Max at each one. Extreme exhaustion is beginning to tell on him. He has to break off from his typing ever more frequently. His head hangs as if about to drop. Hearing steps on the broken glass outside, he now comes fully awake and stares at the door. Through it staggers the wounded Jim Phelps.
Ethan. What are you doing? I needed you, Ethan. I needed you. On the bridge. But you weren't there. Ethan. Ethan.
Ethan's dream of Jim becomes clear in reality. He throws her across the room and covers her with his pistol.
Move. Ethan. Ethan, it's okay. Just calm down. It's clear. It's okay.
You were in the car.
No, I wasn't. I heard it on the radio.
Shut up! I saw you. You were in the car.
No, I got out of the car. I ran to the bridge. He said someone was just...
Don't give me that. I was on the bridge. There was nobody on the bridge.
What happened to Jim?
Wake up, Claire! Jim's dead! They're dead! They're all dead!
She appears devastated. He continues twitchily aiming his pistol into corners.
Who sent you for me?
Jim's dead.
Who sent you here? Take off your coat. Where were you? Where were you?
I walked away. He said, boy, that's just...
That was 4 hours ago. Who sent you? They sent you for me?
Who's they?
They sent you. Who sent you? Who sent you?
No one sent me. We were supposed to be back here at 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock if we were bored. We don't return here until 4 o'clock. Oh, 400, 4 a.m. 4 o'clock, Ethan, 4 o'clock. If we're bored. 4 a.m.
The striking of the clock seems to validate for Ethan what she is saying. He continues holding her down on the bed, but his aggression morphs into what could be physical attraction. Finally, though, he lets his head drop. Dawn breaks over Prague. Ethan is back at the computer.
I've been disavowed. I actually think I killed Jim and everyone else. Somehow $100,000 finds its way into my parents' bank account. Kittredge assumes I'm the mole they've been tracing, and I've been in the employ of an arms dealer, Max, for the last 2 years. If you get him, our knock list.
What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna get it for him.
Ethan, you're not making any sense.
Whoever the mole is, I think goes by the name of Job. I can't find him, but if he knows I have the knock list, he'll find me.
I'm gonna go in and I'm gonna talk to Kittredge myself and I'm gonna tell him you had nothing to do with this.
Claire, if you're not dead, he's gonna assume you're with me.
Ethan's attention is drawn back to the computer, which announces that there is a message awaiting him. He spreads out his arms in astonished gratitude.
The message is for Job.
That's right. I'm going to answer it.
The message reads, Job, corner of Nekazanka and Prikopi, 1 p.m. Buy a pack of Dunhill and ask the man sitting on the bus stop bench for a match. In a busy Prague street, a man with long hair crosses to sit on a bench. Ethan approaches.
Excuse me. Can I trouble you for a match?
The long-haired man strikes a match, summoning a black Mercedes with tinted windows which screams around the corner. The long-haired man opens the rear door for Ethan. The driver turns to him.
Would you remove your hat, please?
Why?
You wish to meet Max? The price of admission.
The man produces a balaclava, the eye and mouth holes of which have been firmly sewn up. Ethan sits, wearing the balaclava still.
I thought I was going to see Max.
You misunderstood. No one sees Max.
What the hell am I doing here?
Allowing Max to see you and hear what you've got to say.
Well, I don't communicate very well through a shroud.
Well, if Max doesn't like what you have to say, you'll be wearing that shroud indefinitely.
I'm willing to take the chance.
A hand gestures for the balaclava to be removed.
Very well.
An elegant woman looks across the desk at Ethan.
Who are you and what are you doing here?
I need $150,000.
Oh, really? You thought if you simply showed up, I might give it to you.
Why not? You gave Job 125.
The penny drops. You are not Job. Job is not given to quoting scripture in his communications. Then there was its tone, aggressive but playful. Job is not playful. So you are something of a paradox.
Well, that depends.
On what?
Whether you like a paradox. I want $150,000 today.
That's quite out of the question.
The disc Job sold you. It's worthless. It's bait. Part of an internal mole hunt.
And how might you know that? You another company man?
Like Job?
We're asking about you.
I'm Nock. Was. Now disavowed.
Why, may I ask?
That is the question I want to ask Job.
I don't know Job any more than Job knows me.
Even so, I'm sure you could arrange an introduction.
Why should I?
Because I can deliver the actual knock list. The one you have is not only worthless, it's certain to be equipped with a homing device to pinpoint your exact location. Boot it up. In anywhere from 30 seconds to 10 minutes, you'll have Virginia farm boys hopping around you like jackrabbits.
It's easy to say the disc is worthless when you say I can't look at the information and see if it's worthless. Not a tenable position, sir.
Okay, use it. But I'd suggest you pack first.
Ethan remains bound in his chair. The elegant woman stands as one of her sidekicks gets out the disc and inserts it into a computer.
$26.27. So far, so good.
Not so good for you, my friend.
I'd say you've got about 2 minutes.
At a look from the woman, the long-haired man crosses the room and steps out onto a balcony overlooking the street. Casts a shrewd gaze at the people and traffic down below. He turns to go back in. As he does so, a number of men in white polythene coats climb out of the back of a van parked below.
32 and 33.
Doesn't mean it's a signal, could just be the hard drive heating up.
Ethan half smiles at this. The men in plastic coats climb the stairs.
44 and 45.
The woman's eyes register concern. Ethan shakes his head. Below in the stairwell, the men in coats have been joined by other agents, some of them recognizable as the other team Ethan had spotted. A female agent covers with her pistol a woman vacuuming the landing. Another agent covers the door to the apartment as the rest prepare to go in. The first man comes through the door, gun drawn, to find no one. As the rest of the team pour in and sweep the apartment, Ethan and the others make their escape across the roof. Kittredge walks calmly into the flat. One of the team approaches him.
Man's gone black, Barnes. He's under until he decides to surface.
Look, we can use somebody at the embassy, involve the local authorities. We can cut off his transportation.
What can we do, Barnes? Put a guy at the airport? How many identities do you think Hunt has? How many times has he slipped past customs in how many countries? These guys are trained to be ghosts. We taught them to do it, for Christ's sake.
Well, what do you suggest?
Let's not waste time chasing after him. Just make him come to us. Everybody has pressure points, Barnes. You find something that's personally important to him, and you squeeze.
The black Mercedes sweeps through Prague.
Gunter will never let me have one of his apartments again. Sorry I doubted you. Dear boy, you are a good sport.
Thanks, Max. Or is it Maxine?
I don't have to tell you what a comfort anonymity can be in my profession. It's like a warm blanket. My deal with Job was subject to a successful boot scan. Obviously didn't pass muster. Deal's off.
What was your deal with Job?
$6 million. I'll give you the same, but I want the complete list now, not just Eastern Europe. I won't do this piecemeal. It's too dangerous. I want the entire list.
$10 million. $10 million in negotiable U.S. Treasury certificates and bearer form coupons attached. And one more thing. Your personal assurance that Job will be at the exchange.
Max flashes him a smile of flirtatious admiration. Ethan is back at the crow's nest. Claire watches as he pulls a huge wad of cash out of a paper bag.
Oh. Max made a deal with you?
I deliver the knock list. Max delivers Job.
We've got 75 rounds for your Beretta, but only 20 for the 6 hour. One pair of visco glasses with monitor. Plenty of passports and...
She is pulled up by Ethan's intense gaze.
Well, you said it yourself. If I'm not dead, I'm with you.
Are you sure about this?
Jim was my husband. I want to get the son of a bitch who did this.
We're gonna need some help. We don't have a lot of time, so they're gonna have to be local.
What kind of help?
Ethan pulls up what appears to be a list of disavowed agents. A high-speed train races through the night. Aboard the train, in a small cabin, Ethan and Claire sit across a table from a heavily built black man with a gold earring and a dark-haired, sparely bearded man smoking a cigarette.
Simple game. Four players. Exfil opens the pocket, CyberOps lifts the wallet.
Bank.
IMF mainframe.
Where exactly is?
In Langley.
In Langley? The one in Virginia, Langley.
Inside CIA headquarters at Langley. Is this serious?
Always.
If we're going to Virginia, why don't we drop by Fort Knox? I can fly a helicopter right in through the lobby and set it down inside the vault. And it would be a hell of a lot easier than breaking into the goddamn CIA.
What are we downloading?
Information.
What kind?
Profitable.
Payment on delivery?
I don't know. I just don't know.
Well, this doesn't sound like the Luther Stickle I heard of. What did they used to call you? The Net Ranger? Phineas Freak? The only man alive who actually hacked NATO GhostCom.
There was never any physical evidence that I had anything to do with that. With that. That exceptional piece of work.
You don't know what you're missing. This is the Mount Everest of hacks.
You're all kidding yourselves. Even with top-of-the-line crypto, Prey Access, Stu 3s.
Trigger can get it, right?
May take a little time.
What the hell do you mean, a little time? It's not what Claire tells me about you.
Thinking machine laptops. I'm talking about the 686 prototypes with the artificial intelligence risk chip.
24 hours.
I get to keep the equipment when we're done.
Luther, I guess you're all out of excuses.
Look, I just can't hack my way inside. See, there's no modem access to the mainframe. It's in what we call the standalone. Which means I'd have to be physically at the terminal.
Relax, Luther. It's much worse than you think. The terminal is in a black vault lockdown. The only person allowed in the room has to pass through a series of security checks.
William Donlow.
The first is a voice print identification and a 6-digit access code. This only gets him into the outer room. Next, he has to pass a retinal scan. And finally, the intrusion countermeasures are only deactivated by a double electronic keycard, which we won't have. Now, inside the Black Vault, there are three systems operating whenever the technician is out of the room. The first is sound sensitive. Anything above a whisper sets it off. The second system detects any increase in temperature. Even the body heat of an unauthorized person in the room will trigger it if the temperature rises just a single degree. Now, that temperature is controlled by the air conditioning coming in through an overhead duct 30 feet above the floor. That vent is guarded by a laser net. The third system is on the floor and is pressure sensitive. The slightest increase in weight will trigger the alarm. And any one of these systems, if set off, will activate an automatic lockdown. Now, believe me when I tell you, gentlemen, all three systems are state of the art.
The floor sensor is triggered by a drop of moisture from the analyst's Coke cup.
And you really think we can do this?
We're going to do it.
A fleet of fire engines speeds through the countryside. Among trees rises up an enormous complex of modern buildings. A caption reads, Langley. In the rear of one of the fire engines, Luther Stickle looks out through the window. Langley employees hurry to the entrance lobby as firemen begin hurrying in through the revolving doors.
Picked up alarms from sector 3, 7, and 12.
Yeah, that's where I've got to.
What sector is the air conditioning?
21, but there's no alarm in sector 21, so I gotta get in there and shut it down.
I'm sorry, but nobody gets into any sector where an alarm hasn't gone off.
Oh, you wanna blow the fire through this whole building?
Look, no one goes into any sector where the alarm hasn't gone off, and it hasn't gone off in 21. Wait.
It's gone off. Let's go.
Let's move.
Luther pushes a button and smiles delightedly. The fire crew and security guards run off into the building. One of the fire crew peels off and heads through a side door. The analyst, Donlow, leaves the vault.
Can I get you anything?
No, thank you.
21's through here.
The security guard admits two of the fire crew into the service room adjoining the Black Vault. Kittredge briefs his team on Ethan.
He's recruiting. For what purpose?
Survival.
Too short-sighted, this guy initiates. He's proactive. The question is, what does he want? Where does he need to get it? And Barnes, what the hell is that noise?
Fire alarm, King.
have to evacuate.
Claire, changed out of her firefighting gear, re-emerges from the side room and sashays elegantly down the corridor. The security guard comes back out of the service room. Claire heads into the canteen just in front of Dunlow. The security guard pauses. Dunlow goes to the coffee machine. Claire sugars her coffee. The security guard speeds up slightly and goes back inside the service room. Ethan, his back to the door, is changing out of his firefighting gear and secreting a latex mask in a bag.
Hey, there were three of you. Where's the other guy?
Zero body count.
We'll see.
Claire follows Dunlow to his table and sits down next to him. He unfolds his paper. She gets out a pad and pen. Seemingly intent on her notes, she fiddles the point of the pen over his cup and squirts something into his coffee. Ethan and the bearded Frenchman start up a vertical air duct using suction hand grips. Dunlow takes a sip of his coffee. Ethan makes it to a horizontal shaft and strains to pull himself up. He crawls along the shaft. He takes a right turn. The Frenchman is close on his heels. Claire deftly applies a tiny adhesive square to Dunlow's suit with the tip of her finger. He looks up and then around at her. She smiles disarmingly. The tiny square sits on the man's shoulder. Luther picks up a tiny pulsing light on his computer schematic of the building.
Hi there.
Ethan and the Frenchman continue crawling along the shaft. Claire gets up to leave. Dunlow glances somewhat wistfully at her sleek rear view, then resumes his coffee. Ethan and the Frenchman continue through the shaft. Ethan arrives at the ceiling hatch, latticed across with infrared beams. He places on the rim of the hatch a cunning device which slices through and short-circuits the beams without triggering the alarm. Through the grill of the hatch, he inserts a device which magnetically undoes and catches the retaining screw. Dunlow checks his watch and folds up his newspaper. Ethan activates and tests out a volume sensor on his wrist.
1, 2, 3. Toast. Toast.
Krieger wipes his nose and looks resentfully at Ethan. Ethan carefully removes the hatch. Suspended on a harness, he is lowered by Krieger headfirst down through the aperture into the vault. His thermometer reads 72 Fahrenheit, then 72.1, 72.2. Krieger strains as he pays out the nylon cord through the pulleys. Ethan drops slowly down towards the workstation in the vault. Luther picks up Dunlow moving through the corridor. He looks uneasy. Dunlow, meanwhile, walks back towards the vault, but already appears to be feeling some discomfort.
He's rolling to you. He's at the voice train corridor.
William Dunlow.
Krieger continues letting out the rope. Dunlow passes through the first of the security checks.
Outer room.
Dunlow crosses to the retinal scanner.
He's coming in the vault. Come on, move.
Krieger hoists Ethan smoothly back up towards the hatch so that he hangs silently near the ceiling. Dunlow enters and the lights come on in the vault. Ethan hangs motionless like a sleeping bat. Luther observes Dunlow on the monitor as the analyst shakes out indigestion pills into his hand and swallows them. He sits down at his screen and tries to focus, but the discomfort he is feeling appears to be increasing. Finally, Dunlow grabs his waste paper bin and retches into it. Slowly and painfully, Dunlow heads for the door, carrying the bin in the crook of his arm. Once the door is closed, Ethan swoops downwards once more. Dunlow hurries through a side door.
He's in a bathroom.
Ethan remains suspended in midair. He gradually spins himself around and then effects a gracefully balletic spin, bringing himself to the vertical supported by the toe of his right foot on the workstation. He deftly finds his balance on the narrow desktop. Dunlow is drying his hands. He is suddenly assailed by another wave of nausea and rushes into a lavatory cubicle. Ethan sets the thermometer on top of the computer terminal. It reads 72.9, 72.8, 72.7. Ethan swings his legs out behind him and holds his body horizontally with his hands on the keyboard. He enters Dunlow's name. It requests his password. Luther provides it. Krieger in the shaft above strains to hold the rope steady. Ethan punches keys on the computer. Luther looks on delightedly. Onto the monitor screen come icons for the knock list files. Luther's face falls.
Holy Mother of God.
The knock list.
Ethan punches the return key and a long list of names begins scrolling up the screen. Krieger appears to be at the limit of his endurance. Further back down the tunnel, a rat appears. Dunlow finishes washing his face and takes a paper towel. Ethan, still suspended in midair like Peter Pan, carefully slides from his waistcoat pocket a small bunch of CDs. With infinite care, he inserts one of them into the computer. Luther eyes the pulsing decibel meter with concern. The rat pitter-pats steadily along the duct towards Krieger. A red message on the screen reads, "Downloading knock list to knock file." The increasing proximity of the rat seems to bother Krieger. The rope seems to slip minutely through his grip. The pulleys strain. The message goes green. Download completed successfully. As Ethan reaches gently to retrieve the disc, Krieger makes a lunge towards the rat, letting go of the rope and causing Ethan to plummet. Ethan stops just short of the floor, dangling perilously, his arms and legs twitching to maintain his balance. The rat lies dead by Krieger's head as he strains to regain his grip on the rope. Luther looks on in anguish. Ethan dangles. The thermometer rises. Dunlow emerges from the washroom. Halfway across the corridor, he hesitates. He then hurries back into the washroom, still carrying his waste bin. Sweat beads on Ethan's forehead. The thermometer has risen to 72.8. A drop of sweat trickles down the lens of Ethan's spectacles and teeters on the lower edge of the frame. Dunlow re-emerges from the washroom. Luther studies the gauges. The temperature remains at 72.8. Dunlow hesitates at the door to the vault's outer room. Krieger exerts superhuman effort to pull on the rope. Another bead of sweat moves down Ethan's glasses to join the other one. As it falls towards the floor, Ethan stretches out a gloved hand to intercept it. Luther breathes a sigh of relief. However, Dunlow now passes through the outer door.
He's at the vault.
Krieger pulls with all his strength. Ethan begins to rise slowly upwards. The rope, no longer on its pulley, rubs noisily on the edge of the hatch.
4 yelps.
Ethan looks at his decibel meter.
1 red.
Dunlow bends his head to the retinal scanner. Krieger pulls like crazy. Ethan retrieves the disc. The thermometer rises to 72.9. The red line of the scanner passes across Dunlow's eye.
Keep moving.
Ethan is yanked back up.
Toast. Toast.
Messy.
Krieger takes the disc from between Ethan's teeth. As he does so, however, he knocks his deadly-looking clasp knife off the edge. Both men stare in horror as it spins slowly through the air. The point of the knife embeds itself in the surface of Dunlow's desk. The knife, perfectly vertical, quivers slightly. Dunlow enters. He stops dead, staring at the dagger. He moves slowly across, looking at the weapon, utterly mystified. He pulls it out of the desk. He looks from its deadly point up towards the ceiling grille, now neatly back in place and once more latticed with infrared beams. He bends to his keyboard and brings up the keystroke log.
Oh my God.
Ethan detonates a smoke grenade in the air duct. Smoke begins to pour down through the grille into the vault. One of Kittredge's lieutenants picks up the phone.
Yeah.
It's for you.
Kittredge.
Two figures in full yellow firefighter rig and mask escort Claire out through the chaos and into the revolving door of the CIA building. The bright red fire tender bowls along a country road. Krieger sits at the wheel wearing a self-conscious half-grin. Next to him, Luther is deep in thought. Claire casts a quizzical look at Krieger. On the other side of the cab sits Ethan, his face impassive, staring ahead.
You and I know about this. That's where it stops. You understand? It never happened.
What about him?
I want him manning a radar tower in Alaska by the end of the day. Just mail him his clothes.
A red double-decker bus toils through teeming rain around the corner by Liverpool Street tube station into Old Broad Street. A title reads, London. In a rented apartment above the station, Luther draws the blinds. Ethan thumps a copy of the Bible onto the table by his laptop. In the next room, Krieger is slumped in front of the TV with a beer in his hand.
You contacting your buyer? Ethan
pores over the Bible and emails Max quotations from the Book of Job.
Ethan,
Krieger gets up and moves through to where Ethan works.
Ethan. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Hunt.
Krieger approaches the desk and tips the Bible off onto the floor.
You're not going to any meeting without me.
My contact is extremely shy.
I don't think you're in any position to give orders. Do you? Not while I'm holding this.
Krieger.
Thank you.
Krieger holds up a disc. Ethan fetches another one from his case.
Don't you mean this?
That's not the least.
But what's the matter? You've never seen this trick?
Ethan assumes the character of a stage magician and deftly palms the disc. Krieger looks worried.
Where'd it go?
Ethan moves over to where Claire stands in a doorway.
It's gone.
What?
You? No.
No? No.
He produces it triumphantly from inside Claire's cardigan.
But not too far. I know what you're thinking, Krieger. You're thinking back in the computer room, I was up here, he was down there. Yes, and he was. He was carrying two discs. It's so hard to keep track of these things.
Where is it?
Ethan, who has made the disc disappear once again, produces it with a flourish from his back pocket.
Do you actually think I'd let you have the knock list?
Try any sleight of hand with my money, I'll cut your throat.
Flinging the disc he holds into the bin, Krieger stalks to the front door and exits. Ethan watches him go, and then stoops to pick up the Bible from the floor. Something on the inside of the cover catches his eye. He looks more closely at the stamped inscription, which reads, "Placed by the Gideons in the Drake Hotel, Chicago."
You're off on one of your cushy recruiting assignments again?
Yeah, where'd they put you up this time? The Plaza?
Drake Hotel, Chicago.
Oh. I'm so sorry.
Ethan is pulled from his reverie by Claire, who walks slowly to him across the room.
Krieger was my call.
She reaches up and touches Ethan's cheek.
I'm sorry.
What we had to do.
I'm going to try and get some sleep.
She bends closer and kisses him on the cheek, a kiss which ever so nearly becomes something more passionate. She walks away, leaving Ethan staring intently after her. He raises his hand to the cheek she kissed, almost as if examining the goods, his face deeply perplexed. He raises his hand to his brow, as if attempting to banish his doubts. He turns away, still seemingly trying to sift through some knotty thoughts. Finally, he turns decisively and crosses to the waste bin. Luther raises his eyes from his work as Ethan bends down and fishes out the disc thrown away by Krieger. He looks on as if stunned.
Krieger did have the knock list?
Ethan holds up the disc and nods almost imperceptibly.
I want you to hold on to it.
What makes you trust me?
Because if you knew what you were getting into, you never would have done it.
I'm not going to let this get out in the open.
Exactly. It's your job tomorrow on the train. Don't let this knock list get out in the open.
Ethan picks up a modified mobile phone Luther has been working on.
What is the range of this thing?
It's hard to tell. You're going to have to be close.
Ethan, I need to talk to you.
The unlikely setting of farm in the heartland of America, the state of Wisconsin, where federal agents claim to have found the brains behind an international drugs ring. The operation was masterminded by Margaret Ethan Hunt and her brother-in-law, Donald Hunt. They were arrested this morning by drug enforcement officers in a major sting operation designed to expose the illegal manufacture of the drug methcathinone, known as CAM.
I'm afraid what we have here
is a case of a naive and lonely widow.
Ethan walks purposefully through the London rain. Claire watches him from the window of the apartment as he crosses the street and walks up into Liverpool Street train station. He comes down the escalator and onto the main station concourse. He crosses to one of a bank of payphones. Kittredge takes the call.
Kittredge.
I see you've been out visiting the folks.
It's Hunt. What do you need for a pinpoint? We've been watching a little TV, have you?
Hauling Mom off to jail in shackles was an especially nice touch. He's in England.
Get MI5. Ethan, I want to assure you that my first order of business after you come in is to have these ridiculous charges against your family dropped and eliminated completely from their files. But if you come in now, we can play down the charges against you as well.
Can I ask you something, Kittredge?
Certainly, Ethan.
If you're dealing with someone who's crushed, stabbed, shot, and detonated
5 members of his own IMF team,
how devastated do you think you're going to make him by marching Ma and Uncle Donald down to the county courthouse?
I don't know, Ethan. Why don't you tell me?
Ethan, eyeing the clock, ends the call.
Austin.
We needed 3 more seconds.
He wanted us to know he was in London.
On the other side of the phone booth glass, a man wearing a fishing hat turns to face Ethan. It is Jim Phelps. He draws close. Ethan cowers slightly as if seeing a ghost.
You're a hard man to catch up with.
Ethan holds Jim's shoulder and looks deep into his eyes.
Next day, I managed to drag myself back to the safe house. Must have just missed you. Anyway, I checked our aliases.
And that's when you picked us up in the States.
But you left before I could get there, and I could check just so many places.
Small countries don't computerize customs records.
So I watched Europe. Once you turned up in England, it was easy.
Well, you know I like the rentals at Liverpool Street.
Hey, I showed them to you.
I remember. Junk. What do you think you're kidding here? Doctor's got to look at that. You can't sit up straight.
I can sit up straight. I just can't sit up straight very well. Sit down. Sit down. It's not important. Ethan. I saw who shot me. I saw them all. It was Kittredge.
Kittredge.
Kittredge, Ethan.
Kittredge is them all. Oh my God, of course you're right. He was at the embassy that night. First he took out Jack at the elevator.
Jim in the crow's nest in Prague punches a button. Jack dies.
He shot you on the bridge.
Phelps, on the bridge in Prague, has shot himself in the arm. He throws the pistol over the parapet and pulls off his gloves. Phelps takes a sponge full of what appears to be blood and daubs his hands and the front of his coat with it. He then holds his hands imploringly up to the lens of his own concealed video camera.
Ethan.
He tips over the bridge parapet and falls into the water below with a huge splash. Ethan's expression is one of pained incredulity as he pieces together events.
He must have had backup take out Gallitzin and Sarah at the vet.
Ethan recalls pulling the knife from Sarah's body and realizes it was the same knife as Krieger had with him at Langley. The knife is pulled from Gallitzin's body by a gloved hand, which turns out to be Krieger's. Sarah arrives and registers shock on seeing him. Hannah hesitates and then gets into the front passenger seat of the parked car. Across the street, a blonde woman stands with a detonator in her hand. She turns. is Claire. Ethan shakes his head.
No. No, he could have done it himself.
Jim's eyes widen in grateful agreement. Jim, crawling back up the riverbank in Prague, holds in his hand the small detonator. He presses it. The car explodes. Ethan comes back from his memory of standing on the bridge watching the blazing car and turns to Phelps.
Why, Jim? Why?
When you think about it, Ethan, it was inevitable. No more Cold War. No more secrets you keep from everyone but yourself. Operations you answer to no one but yourself. And then one day, you wake up. The President of the United States is running the country without your permission. The son of a bitch, how dare he? And you realize it's over. You're an obsolete piece of hardware not worth upgrading. You've got a lousy marriage and 62 grand a year. Kittredge will go after the no-good son of a bitch big time.
We won't have to. He'll come after us.
What's gonna make him do that?
What he didn't get in Prague. The knock list.
Whoa. Jesus, Ethan. Good for you.
A meeting tomorrow on the TGV en route to Paris.
Tight security, no guns. Real plus.
If I supposedly deliver the knock list to Max, Max has agreed to deliver Job to me. I'll have Claire and Luther Stickle with me on the train. Krieger is going to have helicopter transport waiting in Paris. Jim?
I was in a cafe waiting for you, Ethan. And there she was. Standing in the rain, alive and beautiful. Thinking I'm dead and gone. God knows what she's had to do. To forget me, to keep going, to get the job done. She can't know about me, Ethan. No one can. Not till this is over.
You're probably right.
There's too much at stake.
Once we leave the safe house, Jimmy, you get in there and crash. I'll call you from Paris.
You got it.
An email to Max is sent. After a verse or two of Job, it reads, "Meet on TGV noon tomorrow. Take seat 27. Bring our mutual friend, Job." Claire lies in a sleeping bag, leaning up in the corner of the shabby safe house. Ethan enters.
What happened?
Sent a message to Max. We're on for tomorrow.
Claire, her face deadly serious, gazes up at Ethan and slowly nods.
Okay.
She extends her right hand towards him and beckons him with it.
Come here.
He moves slowly towards her. He brushes the tips of her extended fingers with his own. She takes his hand and presses it to her cheek and kisses it. He looks down at her suspect display of passion. The well-known landmark of Tower Bridge rises above a helipad. A small chopper dusts down and from it descend Kittredge and Barnes.
Incoming, sir, for you.
X-ray clean, electronics, and no explosives.
Kittredge accepts the manila envelope from the English agent. Inside are tickets for the TGV.
Jean?
Kittredge accepts the rubberized watch the man holds out to him.
How long to the London terminus?
20, 25 minutes.
You've got 10 minutes, move!
The TGV speeds through the Kent countryside. One of the train windows has its blind almost fully down. Inside, a man in a Mac moves a fishing hat to one side and sits down, removing the battery compartment from the back of what looks like a large ghetto blaster. At a table in one of the carriages, a man opens his briefcase and answers the phone ringing inside it. It is Max's sidekick. She sits beside him.
Yes?
Give me Max.
It's him.
This was not what we discussed.
My apologies, Max. Couldn't be helped. There's a piece of black cloth under your seat. Tear it away, you'll find the disc.
As Max leans down to find the concealed disc, the man alone in the cabin pulls cunningly hidden items out of the ghetto blaster, assembling them into a gun. Max hands the black-wrapped disc to her sidekick, who slots it into his laptop. The knock list spools up onto the screen. A green message flashes, "Identity match."
Dear boy, I hope this doesn't preclude a meeting in private.
Not as long as you tell me where the money is.
The mere possibility is worth 10 million. Baggage car wreck, 3. Silver briefcase combination 314.
What about Job?
Wouldn't worry about him when you get the money. He'll find you.
The man in the cabin slots cartridges into his cunningly constructed gun. Kittredge and his lieutenants move along the aisle of the train. Claire sits in a window seat. She glances up, sees Kittredge, and turns her face swiftly away.
What's the matter?
It's not transmitting.
Try it again. Damn it, I've got to get this through before we hit the channel.
Luther sits on the other side of the aisle from Max. Sitting on the table beside him is the modified mobile phone he was working on in the safe house. It is pointed at Max's sidekick's laptop.
What's the problem?
Connection denied.
I can see that. Did you check the batteries?
I always check the batteries.
Don't you give me that. Run it through from the top.
Luther looks up and sees Kittredge approaching.
This is some bullshit. We don't even know what Max looks like.
Look, we don't need to know. If he's got that list, he's going to want to check it, and that means laptops.
Luther closes his laptop and, leaving the mobile sitting on the table, turns and walks away up the aisle. A helpful steward notices and takes the mobile to him.
Excuse me, sir.
Hello?
Your telephone?
Hello? I can't hear anything.
Is everything all right, sir?
It's just the battery is gone.
It's working.
Max's long-haired sidekick spots Luther and follows him. Max picks up her phone and dials. The man with the gun answers.
He's in the baggage car.
Ethan, Kittredge is on the train.
I'm right behind you. The money's in the baggage car. I'll meet you there.
The man with the gun leaves his cabin and walks off down the aisle. Kittredge continues up the train. Claire brushes past him. Kittredge looks up and notices Max's long-haired sidekick shouldering a door at the end of the carriage.
Barnes?
As Kittredge approaches, the long-haired man stands demurely and then follows Claire into the next carriage. As Claire moves further up the train, the long-haired man sits down in a seat. Kittredge and Barnes stop at the door. Inside, Luther braces himself. Barnes pulls something out from his wallet and appears to insert it in the lock as Kittredge stands guard. Claire continues towards the baggage car. In the gloom sits Phelps.
Ethan's right behind me. Listen, Jim. Is it such a good idea to kill him? Kittredge is here. We take the money. Ethan takes the blame. No one else has seen you alive. No believe him.
She gazes at Phelps. He turns silently towards her. He extends his left hand across to his right jaw. He pulls away the latex, grotesquely distorting the features and then revealing Ethan himself. Claire stares in terrified bewilderment.
Of course, I'm very sorry to hear you say that, Claire.
Ethan.
Yes. Ethan Hunt, darling. You remember him, don't you?
Phelps comes out of hiding, gun drawn.
You knew about Jim?
Of course. Just exactly when he knew is something of a question. Mind telling me, Ethan? Before or after I showed up in London?
Before London. But after you took the Bible from the Drake Hotel in Chicago.
They stamped it, didn't they? Those damn Gideons.
Ethan, if you knew about Jim, why?
Why the masquerade? Why take the risk? Well, Claire, you've asked the question. And you are the answer.
I knew about Jim.
But he didn't know about you. In all fairness, Ethan, Claire was never convinced her charms would work on you. But I was supremely confident, having tasted the goods. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, Ethan.
Let's just get the money and get out of here.
Yes, let's get the money.
Ethan. The money.
Give her the money. You've earned it.
They exchange a look. She holds up the sheaf of bonds and then hands them across to Phelps.
All 10 million.
No, Claire was wrong about one thing, Jim.
Oh? What's that?
Ethan gestures for permission to pull something from his breast pocket. Phelps looks on, bemused, as Ethan pulls out a pair of glasses. Phelps's expression changes to one of horror as Ethan puts the glasses on. Kittredge picks up the image of Phelps on his rubberized watch screen.
Morning, Mr. Phelps.
I'm not the only one who's seen you alive.
You son of a bitch.
It's over, Jim.
Ethan throws the glasses at Phelps.
Don't, Jim.
Don't, Jim.
Phelps has shot Claire and viciously beaten Ethan to the floor. Ethan comes round slowly and then crawls across to Claire. He takes her fondly in his arms and looks into her face. Her eyes, however, do not open. Ethan's expression crystallizes. He seems intent on revenge. In the corner of the baggage car, a metal ladder leads to a hatch in the roof, which is open. Ethan crosses to it and climbs out onto the roof. Outside, his face is distorted by the 150-mile-an-hour wind. The train speeds along, passing beneath a low brick bridge. Phelps is moving towards the rear of the train. A helicopter swoops overhead. It is piloted by Krieger, who brings the craft down towards the train. Phelps uses a pair of vacuum suckers to anchor himself as he works his way back along the roof. Ethan, not having the advantage of suckers, makes a leap and is swept several meters along the train roof. His jacket and tie flap around his head, so he rips them off and throws them away. Alerted by the flying clothes, Phelps turns and looks back to see Ethan in pursuit. Phelps beckons to Krieger. Ethan does a daring flip and gets a finger hold further towards Phelps. Phelps uses his suction pads to spin himself around to where he can lash a loop of nylon webbing onto the train roof. Attaching a carabiner to his belt, Phelps waves Krieger down closer. The train speeds along towards the white concrete of the entrance to the Channel Tunnel, a mile or so in the distance. Krieger stares in alarm. He pulls in overhead, dangling a cable which Phelps grabs, intending to clip it to his carabiner. Ethan spots this, however, and lets go his grip so that he careens back, knocking Phelps over and grabbing the cable and clipping it to the train itself. Phelps kicks him so hard that he slips over the edge but still manages to cling to the side of the train. Krieger desperately attempts to pull away. The helicopter is sucked along in the train's slipstream as it plunges on towards the tunnel entrance. At the very last moment, Krieger pushes forward on the joystick and follows the train into the tunnel. Max looks at the screen of the laptop, which flashes a red connection lost message. A train guard watches the helicopter from the rear window.
No, don't crash into us! Accelerate!
Phelps struggles back up the train roof and unclips the helicopter cable. He then slides back down onto the sloping rear end of the train. Ethan remains clinging for dear life onto the side of the train. Phelps beckons to Krieger. Ethan gets a foothold and begins to reach up for one of Phelps's abandoned suction grips. Another train is coming the other way. Ethan sees the approaching headlights and redoubles his efforts to get his fingers onto the suction handle. In the very nick of time, he hoists himself back up to relative safety. Krieger struggles to keep the helicopter on an even keel as the other train hurtles past. Phelps pushes himself up and reaches out for the landing runner of the helicopter. Seeing this, Ethan lets go and slides down to the nose of the train. Phelps straddles the helicopter's undercarriage. Krieger smiles in triumph and then, his smile becoming more malicious, inches the rotor blade down towards Ethan's neck. As the lower edge of the rotor blade tilts towards Ethan, the upper edge clips the roof of the tunnel. As Krieger struggles to rebalance the craft, Ethan leaps from the train to the helicopter's other runner. Looking across at Phelps on the other side, Ethan pulls out and unwraps one of his sticks of chewing gum explosive.
Grenade! Grenade!
Ethan presses the blob of explosive onto the Perspex dome of the helicopter's nose. The blast of the explosion sends him flying through the air to land on the rear of the train. He clings to one of the windscreen wipers as the ball of twisted burning metal that was the helicopter bounces and rolls along the tunnel behind him. The train slows, causing the helicopter wreck to slam into it, leaving Ethan spread-eagled and with the sword-like remnants of one of the rotor blades pointing at his exposed throat. The train guard's head pops up into the window frame, eyes and nostrils wide in terror. He takes in the scene and then drops back in a dead faint. Luther retrieves the knock list and hands it to Kittredge.
I think this is what you're looking for. Hello, Max.
My lawyers are going to have a field day with this. Entrapment, jurisdictional conflict.
Maybe we'll just leave the courts out of this one.
I'm sure we can find something I have that you need.
In a freak accident, a helicopter lost altitude, veered into a tunnel, and collided with a high-speed train on its way from London to Paris. The pilot was killed, but no one on the train was hurt.
Ethan emerges into a pub beer garden.
Meet you folks. How are they feeling?
About what?
An apology from the Justice Department. VIP treatment, you know, the whole nine yards.
Well, my mom was a little confused how the DEA could mistake her and Uncle Donald for a couple of dope smugglers in the Florida Keys.
Just Cheers.
To you, Luther. And being off the disavowed list.
Hey, I'm the flavor of the month. Why don't you come back with me?
I just don't know why I'd be doing it. Gotta go catch my flight.
So how's it feel to be a solid citizen again?
Man, I don't know. I'm gonna miss being disreputable.
Well, Luther, if it makes you feel any better, I'm always thinking that way.
Ethan pats Luther on the shoulder and walks away. A plane in mid-flight. Ethan dozes in first class. The stewardess approaches him.
Excuse me, Mr. Hunt. Would you like to watch a movie?
No, thank you.
Would you consider the cinema of the Caribbean? Aruba, perhaps.
Ethan is dozing no longer. He looks at the stewardess. The end.